So, an English teacher to the general manager of the great radio station in Philadelphia. How did that all start out?
Didn't start out being a English teacher.
What?
I started out being a radio guy in college. And at the end of my college career, I decided, well, this is too much fun. I can't possibly do this for a living. So let me do something else, which meant I went and got a master's degree and started teaching. And after 1 year of teaching, I realized I couldn't make a living there either. So let's try to get a little more money and do some part-time radio work. So I got a job weekends at FLN.
How did you work your way up from being that weekend guy to being the program director and the operations manager and the...
I also made the coffee in the morning.
That does help.
Let's see. I was working weekends and Monday afternoons at FLN. So when I finished teaching in Camden, I'd drive across the river up to Roxborough, work from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m., go home, go back to teaching Tuesday, and then, of course, I had 2 8-hour shifts on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Eventually, that became untenable. And I said, look, the next time you have an opening, would you consider me for a full-time job? And it so happened they had an opening very soon thereafter when John Edwards passed away. So they said, here, we've got 40 hours to fill. So I got, let's see what the schedule was then. I worked Saturday from 2 to 10 p.m., Sunday from 2 to 10. Monday was officially the day off, but I had to be in at 10 o'clock Monday night to work Monday night to Tuesday morning, and then I worked Tuesday night to Wednesday morning. And did I have Thursday off? Because I know on Fridays, I got off at 10 o'clock, but I had to be back in at 6 o'clock Saturday morning.
Wow. I have a question.
Sure.
What was so attractive about radio to you? What drew you to radio and this schedule?
Well, I was 25 years old when I had that schedule, so it really didn't bother me too much. I was only late once. I forgot what day it was, I guess. Because I liked the music. My grandmother was a pianist, my uncle a harpsichordist. I got involved in listening to classical music radio where I grew up in North Jersey, so I had WQXR to listen to, WNCN, which was FM only. Of course, back in those old days, very few people had FM radios. You certainly didn't have them in your car. But those are the stations I listened to, and I came down here and I listened to FLN while I was in college, and it just seemed like a natural for me. I liked the music, I was fairly good with languages, and that's how it worked.
Now, the step from working all those days and overnights and afternoons to the step to being in management, that's a pretty big step.
Well, it didn't come all at once. They decided somewhere along the line that the fellow who was doing the morning shift was pilfering things from the station, mostly records, LPs. And they offered me the morning shift, which in those days went from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. It was an 8-hour shift, but at least it was full-time, and it was Monday through Friday. So I took that. Then I guess it was another year. I figured out a schedule where I could get off at 10 o'clock, so only do those 4 hours, because they made me program director. They said, you seem to have a gift for this, as strange as that may seem. And so I worked 6 to 10 and then did program director's duties. Eventually, actually the fellow who hired me was Jim Keeler, who had worked at FLN for quite a number of years. He moved on to work at the opera company. I guess it was the Lyric Opera at the time, and then moved on to Detroit. So I became vice president programming until the station was sold in 1988, and I had to relinquish that title, which didn't mean anything because it didn't come with any extra money. But the new owners kept me on as program director.
Now, I can remember listening as a younger man to the station back then.
As they say, when you were in a younger man's clothes.
Right. But you seem to bring more personality to it than I had heard up to that point.
We were told by ownership that we weren't allowed to give our names when I started there.
What?
Mm-hmm. Because all of the voices were interchangeable, nobody was particularly interested in hearing who we were. When I became program director, I got it through that it might be a good idea for people to know who it was they were listening to, and so we were allowed to give our names at the beginning of a shift and the end of a shift, which meant if you worked an eight-hour shift, which most of them did, people still didn't know who you were. But it seemed the music shouldn't be stuffy. I mean, the presentation shouldn't be stuffy. The music it's entertainment, really, and the host should be somewhat entertaining.
Well, I know listening to you do that is what interested me in doing it, because I was interested in radio, but hearing you have that bit of personality interested me in working in classical music radio, which is an interesting thing, because it was sometimes dull listening to others, and you were there, and you just lit up the room with what
you
did.
Well, thank you. I never thought of myself as lighting up anything. I haven't smoked in about 40 years.
Now, the big question that everyone always asks is, how was it that the Suze Alarm became a thing? Because you started that how many years ago?
It was back in the early 90s, I guess. Again, commercial radio quite often is driven by the advertiser, not by the audience. And we had an advertiser who liked marches, and he'd been putting money into a Saturday march program. And the new owners of the station at that time thought that this would be a lot of fun, but they found a sponsor in, I think it was Maxwell House. We figured, well, we'd make it a wake-up call. So 7:15, we'd play a march, and then we'd give out, we'd get somebody's name, send them a certificate, and a gift certificate for Maxwell House coffee went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Sponsorship didn't last that long, but people liked the march, so we kept it.
Yeah. Without the Maxwell House part.
Without the Maxwell House part. In fact, I had to take that off the certificate.
Oh.
It was right there in the certificate.
And I suppose the other part of the morning show at that time was your good
Dick
friend,
James.
Dick James, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
I'm sorry, what?
Dick James. He was the director of the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center. And he would do a little weather forecast. It was a back and forth. He had a microphone on his desk at the Nature Center down the road. So we didn't see each other. We didn't have anything prepared. It was just, I would open the mic, say something, and he'd come back. And he was a very funny guy. He had a great laugh. So we had a lot of fun for those 2 minutes. I guess it was 7:45 and 8:45.
I remember. And it was a scream.
It was fun. It really was fun.
Well, you've gone from not being able to say your name to having these funny exchanges on the radio. Were you ever nervous when you first started?
Are you kidding? Absolutely. In fact, the first shift I was to do at the college station, I had to go to the men's room several times before I could work up the courage to get behind the microphone. But I wanted to do it. I wanted to be on the air. And I was thoroughly terrified when I first started at FLN, because here, this is a professional station. I'm actually going to get paid for this stuff now. And it was unnerving.
Was there some great piece of advice that someone gave you that helped you go ahead and do it?
Not really. The fellow whose place I took, who was there on an interim basis, basically what he told me to do was how to file away the LPs at the end of a shift.
And there were a lot of them.
How to get them into alphabetical order, and so that it was easy to put them on the shelves.
It's fascinating history there, and of course, we all survived the sales that went along with WFLN's ownership over the years, and we ended up here almost 20 years ago.
Almost. A little over 19. We had five owners in 14 months in the death throes of FLN, and that could make you just a little loony. Because each owner had a different idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Each owner had a different idea of what the station should sound like.
You've been, I guess, for 50 years, you've really shaped classical music radio in Philadelphia. And
if you say so.
I believe that. I really do. You've also been involved in a number of things with classical music organizations. And for many years, we did the Philadelphia Orchestra Radiothon.
Can you talk about that, those early days with the Philadelphia Orchestra? Because I recall from some of our pitching times together, stories about interviews way up in the Peanut Gallery.
Oh, those were, yeah, we did our orchestra broadcasts every week, but every once in a while there'd be a live one. And we would have, these were in the Academy of Music. And the only place where we could interview anyone was up on the third floor. It was a long walk. And many of the artists didn't want to do it. The worst ever was an interview with Alfred Brendel, who had just played one of the Beethoven concertos. And at intermission, he was to come upstairs and we would chat for a couple of minutes. He was a yes and no kind of interview. It was death. It was just, I mean, a fantastic pianist. And I guess off mic, he could talk. But from what I've heard from other people, not terribly loquacious. He just would give you a direct answer. And in many cases, it was simply a yes or a no. It was a long interview.
I'm sure. Now, you were the national voice of it, though, for a while. A long time, weren't you?
In the late 70s, into the 80s, and FMT in Chicago took it over for a while, and then we got it back at the, I guess, the last couple of years before FLN died. And then a couple of years here, and then the orchestra went a different direction for a while.
Well, you have interviewed a lot of people in the business, a lot of musicians, a lot of soloists. Was that in connection with the orchestra broadcasts?
Sometimes it was just a special program we were putting together. The one I remember particularly was I was a newbie, and I was given a tape recorder to go up to New York and talk with Pavarotti. And I met him at his hotel, and we talked for about a half an hour. He was very gracious. I got back on the train to come back to Philadelphia and realized that I had never pushed record.
Oh, no. Oh.
Never pushed record. I had an opportunity to speak with him later in Philadelphia when he was with the opera company voice competition. Those went better.
You did push the record button.
I made sure I pushed the record. But I never went back to New York. I mean, you couldn't do that. Sorry, we have to do this all over again because I'm an idiot.
When was that interview with Pavarotti?
It was in the early 70s, I guess.
Wow.
Mid-70s.
You could have practiced your Italian accent and just faked it on the way back on the train, maybe. It
would have been easier for him to fake an American accent.
So here we are here now, all these years later, and still involved with the orchestra. And people still turn to you for advice on all of these things. And reason we're doing this, and we didn't say it at the outset, is that you are retiring at the end of this month. And so we wanted to get some thoughts from you and some experience from you. I'm sure that you have many, many more stories about the old days.
But some of those people are still alive, so I have to keep those to myself for a while. I'll put it in my book.
All right.
I was going to ask you, do you have any specific stories in your head about bloopers? And they always say when things go wrong, people say, oh, live radio. I wondered if you had any stories.
I have a really good one, but we can't put that on the air.
Oh.
Okay.
But we had a production manager at FLN. These are the days of tape cartridges. All the commercials were on individual tape cartridge. And he did them alphabetically. He had them listed in this rack alphabetically.
And there were a lot of them.
A lot of them, and they were right over the turntable, too. So every day at the end of his shift, around 5 o'clock, he's getting ready to go home. He comes in and he starts rearranging all of these tapes because, after all, a new client comes in, alphabetize, have to make all those changes. So one day I was just about to open my microphone as the table on my left was coming to an end, the music on my left was coming to an end, and I had the one on the right underneath this cart rack, all queued up and ready to go, and I hear this crash, and bzzz. He dropped one of the carts, or two of the carts, or three of the carts, I don't remember how many, right onto the LP that was about to go on. My microphone was open. And by the time I turned around, he was out. The door had already closed. He was gone. I don't like to remember bloopers.
Well, some of them are humorous now. Might not have been then, I suppose. But
you've also, that story reminds us that radio has changed so much in the last, actually in the last couple decades, let alone 50 years, that radio has changed a lot. And it
well,
could
the
have
equipment
gone,
has changed a lot.
Well, I was going to say it could have gone the way of the railroads, but it hasn't. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on what the secret is to the enduring appeal of radio.
Well, first of all, we didn't merge with the New York Central. That was probably a very good move. Radio is personal. People pick their radio station and the host that they enjoy, and they think of them as somebody in the room with them, part of their life. And that's what's kept radio alive. It's a very different setup from what it was when I started, and Jack, from when you started. No more tape cartridges, no more turntables. Everything is more digitized. We used to, of course, use reel-to-reel tapes and grease pencils and
razor blades
to edit. Now it's all done on screen with software. And, of course, now there's an awful lot of radio that's not even being broadcast. It's all on the Internet. But it's still radio. It's still there. I think it will be for a long time.
I think that goes back to your original point that when you started, you weren't even supposed to say your name, but you have allowed your personality to come through, and it's what people turn the radio on for, is to hear real people, and we have you to thank for that.
Well, I'll take the compliment, although I'm not sure it's earned. I was thinking a moment ago about my first experience as a radio host, and it actually has nothing to do with real radio. My father used to have one of these big, old Wallenzach tape machines, you know, portable, they cost 55 pounds. Mm-hmm. And I would take it into my bedroom, and I'd get my records out, and I'd introduce a record, and then I'd walk across the room and start, and then put my microphone next to the music, and then it was done, I'd come back, and I'd say something. I'd read the newspapers. That was the newscast. I had a special theme song for the newscast. I think it was the Guadalcanal March from Victory at Sea.
Uh-huh.
And then after going through all of these maneuvers, I would sit down and I would take out that razor blade and splice things. I'm sure that I didn't splice them correctly. I probably didn't do them on a bias. I didn't stain. Mm. All of that stuff comes apart. Fortunately, none of those tapes exist.
Well, I was just thinking, wouldn't it be great to find them somewhere?
I don't think so. They're long gone. But I was so intrigued by radio, even, I mean, I'm talking now, I guess, middle school, or junior high school, as they used to call it. And then, as I said, when a friend of mine and I started listening to QXR and going out and buying LPs and saving my lunch money to buy the next LP instead of having whatever they were serving.
Right.
It's something in my high school, once a week, it was called Johnny Marzetti. I don't know what it was or who it was, but I never had it. Couldn't
but
bring myself.
But not buying that enabled you to buy the recordings. And now, what, many years later, we used to broadcast from Tower Records down on South Street.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Tower Records remotes. I interviewed Savalish for the first time at a Tower remote. We also had some interesting people, audience members who would come in and make themselves known. One young fellow who was always standing too close to the equipment, getting ready to unplug things. I mean, and his parents would just drop him off there, and they'd head to the back of the store.
Uh-huh.
Well, those were quite events. I remember them. Wasn't one done in Liberty Place as well?
Well, no, that was part of the orchestra radiothon.
Right.
We did them in, we did them in Liberty Place.
Bellevue?
We did a couple at the Bellevue. that was a strange one because we were down on the ground floor right in front of this water fountain, which made it sound as if we were in the men's room. Constant flow of water behind us.
And it'd be, never mind.
Yeah, I think we did I think we did one from King of Prussia at one point, too.
Oh.
One or two out there.
Well, that tradition of going out into the community and doing radio in the midst of people is continuing today, too, with the houses in Fairmount Park this month.
That's tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it shows how exciting it is for people to actually come up and see a little bit, just a little bit of what makes this sound come out across the airwaves.
I remember one of the early times somebody came to the station to get a tour and met me, and they said, "Somehow I always thought you people wore tuxedos and ate cheese while you were on the air." I think I had a pair of holy jeans on and a sweatshirt at the time.
So when people meet you out in the real world, are they surprised?
Yes, I'm much thinner and younger.
And do you find yourself being recognized by your voice when you go?
Occasionally. I remember a number of years ago going out to eat and the restaurant downtown, and my then wife ordered something, and then I ordered something, and he said, "You're in radio." He said, "Yeah, how'd you know? Did I announce that?" I said, "Yeah." I announced what I was having. I didn't just ask.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered a marvelous career. We've scratched the surface of a marvelous career. And to sit down with you for more than half an hour would bring out all sorts of other stories. But
can I ask one more question?
Sure.
What's the most fun thing about doing radio for you?
It's all fun. The parts that aren't fun are the budgeting and university and FCC rules and regulations you have to keep up on. But it is fun. Dealing with people, audience members as well as colleagues. It's been a great group of people to work with. Probably the brightest, most motivated group I've ever had to, I've ever worked with. Somebody asked me what parting words I would have, and I can only think of the old chestnut: if you find something you love, you won't work a day in your life. I think that's the way it works. But that's pretty much it. When you love something, don't mind getting up at 3:30 in the morning.
And you haven't worked. You haven't worked a day in your life for 51 years now. So.
Well, it's been a pleasure working with you.
Ditto.
And we'll miss you terribly.
And Jack, yes. 25 years with you.
Yes.
Boy, those years have gone by fast.
They really have. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Oh, I forgot to hit record.
Oh.
Thank you, Luciano.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.